It's Sunday, July 21st, 2013, and this is the Retro Computing Roundtable, Show 55.
But no matter where I go, this is the one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
The RCR is the podcast about computer history, nostalgia, and collecting. By computer history enthusiasts for computer history enthusiasts. I'm today's host, and I'm Earl Evans. Next, we have David Grealish.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, David. How are things your way?
Things are going very well. I think, as I was saying before the show, it's been doing this in all the Southeast. It's been just pouring, raining all the time. It's like, I don't know when the last time my yard was dry. So today it's dry, and it's a sunny, clear day, so I'm out in the garage. Going through stuff and kind of enjoying myself, setting up some things. So
cool.
So finally, for me to work in my garage, I got to pull things out. I'm going towards the driveway here, so I got stuff out here on the driveway too, so I can kind of and make
room.
Like
the puzzle game.
Yeah, got to put stuff out. So like bicycles and vehicle toppers. You know, like when you travel or whatever, and the lawnmower and stuff like that. Get it out of the way.
Hmm.
So it's been a good Sunday, good weather.
Well, good.
But how about you? Now, before we get to our guest co-host, tell us a little bit about your trip. Because you went to Japan. You were on the last show.
Yeah. Just a week ago, I got back from an 8-day trip to Japan, and I loved it. Speaking of the weather was the only thing that was a little challenging for us. It was extremely hot and humid. And
really?
People think of Portland maybe as humid because it rains here so much, but, you know, it's honestly not that humid. It's just rainy. Mm-hmm. But over there, it was hot and like 50%+ humidity. And so I was dying a little bit from that, but the trip, man, everything went perfect. We had perfect travels. We hit all the things we wanted to hit and didn't have any snags anywhere along the way. It was just great. I mean, it was everything I expected and more. So had a fun time.
I guess you expected things to be expensive, right? So was it what you expected, or was it like...
It was cheaper.
Oh, my God. Oh, was it cheaper?
It was cheaper than what I anticipated, and for a couple of reasons. One is, I think the expense is exaggerated a little bit when people talk about it. I mean, yeah, if you go and stay in the super nice hotels and go out to fancy food and things, it can be expensive. But if you just kind of, in a sense, rough it, you know, stay in the second-tier hotels and just eat from just your vendors, you know, there on the shopping areas, and that it actually wasn't all that expensive. The other thing that worked in our favor is right now the yen-to-dollar exchange rate is pretty favorable for Americans. Mm-hmm. It's a little over 100 yen to the dollar, and not too long ago it was 80-something. So,
wow.
Yeah, so I think we hit it right at the right exchange rate.
Cool.
Yeah, we had a great time. Saw lots of stuff, new and old. But, you know, maybe I'll chat a little bit more about that in the closing. But
okay.
Without further ado, I want to also get to our guest here, Jeff Salzman, who I think this is the second time you're joining us on the roundtable, right?
He's family now.
Yeah, it is the second time, and I'm glad you guys invited me.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you along. And I see you've got some cool computer stuff behind you there.
Old and new and a little bit something in between.
Nice. And how are things going for you?
Keeping busy, just trying to get through this heat wave in the Northeast, which is probably 95% humidity. It's nasty.
Well, I was kind of chuckling because when Earl said 50% humidity, because I don't know what it is here in northern Georgia, but it's got to be 80-something percent, I'm guessing. But, you know, I'm born and raised in Florida where it's like over 90%, you know, my entire life.
Wow.
So, it's, you want to talk tropics, that's... I mean, I guess maybe, you know, you get used to it more so. But
that must be it. I mean, already by a few days into it, I was starting to acclimate. But the first day, I was like, holy cow, what is this? It's like I'm breathing water. I felt like a fish.
And then there's no relief. As far as you can get out of the direct sunlight, but you're still hot.
Right.
The air, the more the humidity is, because the air's hot, you know, the steam.
But the one thing I noticed there in Japan is everything was air-conditioned when you got inside. The stores, even the trains, You get on the train, it's like, ooh, you just wanted to ride the train all day. So
sounds like fun anyway.
Oh, it was, boy, yeah. Anyway, I could take the whole show and talk about that trip, but I won't. I will also mention that Carrington is traveling, like we said, on his way to Kansas Fest. So he'll pop in later and say hi. We hope.
I think he will.
Yeah, that would be fun.
If not, I'm prepared to fill in for him. I got
nice
a shrink wrap piece of software I'm willing to open.
Ooh, Carrington would love that. He'd be sorry that he'd be missing seeing that, the desecration of some retro software.
Yeah, this is very retro stuff here. It's from the Panasonic computer.
Wow.
Panasonic, was it JR? I have one here. JR200U.
Is that one of the MSX type systems?
Nope, it's its own thing, kind of like the...
Oh, look at that.
It's its own thing, kind of like the... what is it? Like, I would say like a Mattel Aquarius or the Tomy Tutor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is neat. Well, you ought to talk about that a little bit when it, you know, comes back around.
One of these days I might actually plug it in and turn it on. I have a habit of, you know, have a habit of not doing that. I get these things and...
Oh, you
and
collected
then I leave
it?
For later.
It's never been powered on?
Not by me.
Oh, how fun.
I got this as part of a collection somebody gave me. Some lady, her husband had passed away, and he had this whole slew of Commodore equipment that she gave to me, I guess because I was the only one who answered the request. And so I have a whole bunch of Commodore stuff from him, which, you know, made me very happy because I'm a big Commodore fan. But then a couple months later, she said, I found more stuff. And that was included in it, that Panasonic. So apparently he dabbled in some of the rare stuff that's out there. I'm almost afraid to touch it. Cool. It's like, wow, you know, this is in nice condition, but what's going to happen when I power it up? You know, how many electrolytic capacitors are going to blow?
Right. You always get worried that the magic smoke is going to come out.
That's right. That Panasonic smoke doesn't smell good.
But speaking of which, that kind of leads me into the host topic. As the host, I get to pick a topic. So I want to get you guys' thoughts on the future of retro computing. And I actually covered this in an episode on RetroBits, but I thought I'd you know, bring that forward a little bit here and talk about it on the RCR. So we've already seen some trends over the last... David, you've probably been in this the longest out of any of us in terms of computer collecting and retro computing. But over these years, we've seen some trends start to emerge, like things that didn't used to be rare. Like people would give you a PDP-8 if they had one that was in industrial use, and nowadays you'd spend a few thousand bucks for it on eBay. So, and of course, the Apple IIs and like crazy, the Apple I's, the prices of those have been skyrocketing. A personal collector like me could never have one of those at this point. But I had some other trends that I was interested in you guys' thoughts on. For instance, what modern systems, what are we using today in our day-to-day walk that might become vintage or of interest to collectors? Or are they just going to be so commodity that, you know, they won't be interesting ever? Also, how long until things like the Commodore 64 that you can still get for... just not very much money. I mean, because they made so...
A lot of cases, yeah.
Yeah, they made so stinking many millions of them that, often you can still get one just given to you. I was at a club meeting not too long ago, and I got a Commodore 128 that was just given to me. But I don't expect that to continue. But how long before things like that become rare just due to attrition? And also, is retro computing a fad? Is this a hobby that's going to fade out? And, you know, well, that was kind of fun, but, you know, that was just a nostalgia phase like bell bottoms or something like that, and it'll go away. Or will it be, become bigger? Will more and more people get interested in it? So,
you put a lot on the table.
I know. I got a lot of stuff out there. You don't got to answer all of it. Just pick and choose. Jeff, why don't we start with you? What are your thoughts? What's vintage computing going to look like in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years?
Let's see, 5 years from now, I don't think it'll change much in 5 years. We may look at the desktop PC a little differently with more tablets and mobile phones doing a lot of our computing work. But as far as retro computing, I could see where it could be considered a fad. I hope it's not. It depends on what you do with the stuff. If you just power it up to reminisce, yeah, then people might forget about it. But if you power it up to try to put it to use, just because you have a niche to scratch, you want to see if this can do something, then I think it'll last a lot longer, the whole idea of retro computing. You know, we have these old systems. Can they still fulfill a purpose? That's one question you have to ask. And that's one question I ask myself when I look at my collection and I decide if I want to pare it down or anything. Does this stuff serve a purpose for me, or am I collecting it to, you know, keep it valuable, keep it from getting thrown away and forgotten about? These arguments have been asked and heard before. I don't know how well we can define the answer to it.
Mm-hmm.
As you were saying, 5 years from now, I just don't see much 5 years from now, but 20 years from now, I'm afraid to say that a lot of people might forget it, because now we're, what, two, maybe three generations ahead? Unless somebody's around to, you know, keep it going, people are going to forget about it, or they'll get the wrong idea about it.
Mm-hmm.
They'll forget what it did, and they'll have some idea that's not practical, or, you know, it doesn't make any sense. I don't know what would be a good example, but, you know, some people may forget how they worked back in their day, what purpose they served.
I see. Well, you know, my son plays this game called Team Fortress 2, and it's a first-person shooter, and I know that when a lot of us pull out our vintage computers, one of the things that we do is gaming, and I do that some. I'm not a big gamer, either modern or old computers, but that really is a big part of the hobby for a lot of people. And I'm wondering if 20 years from now, my son is going to be trying to dig up one of these quaint octa-core computers so that he can light up Team Fortress 2 and, you know, play it like they did 20 years ago, or if that whole thing is just going to be a foreign concept. It's like today, nostalgia for us is what things looked like maybe in the 70s or 80s or 90s. I'm wondering 20 years from now, what will retro computing look like for the folks who are playing with computers now? Or will it even be a thing? I mean, maybe they'll just move on to the next thing.
Yeah, I can relate to that. My son's 15, and he plays those kind of online games. I don't know if it's Team Fortress 2. I think he plays with Gary's Mod a lot. I forget what that is.
Gmod. Yeah.
Yep. But he's into that stuff, and, you know, he and I had a short talk about that. You know, what's going to happen when that's not around anymore? What are you going to do? And he didn't quite have an answer. But he could be just like me in the future, where he remembers it. He may leave it be for a while, and that's what I did with classic computing. I just left it go for a while. Like, mostly in the 90s, I really wasn't into it much, but then nostalgia kicks in. So I tried to find all the old stuff that I had, including some of the stuff I had, you know, at my parents' house or whatever. And then getting back into it, it's like, wow, you know, there's a whole lot that these things did that I either couldn't afford to do or couldn't acquire for whatever reason, and now it's really cheap, and now I can explore more with what I wasn't able to do before. So at an advanced age, I won't say advanced, at a later age, I can now relive some of the stuff I couldn't do, or I saw somebody else doing because, you know, they had a little money to buy the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But for gaming, we have the same kind of networking to do those kind of games like Team Fortress. Will we have the internet the
way
it is?
That's true.
Will we have Ethernet, or will people be digging up old Ethernet cards and trying to bridge it to some new fiber optic system to be able to relive that day and age?
Yeah.
There's a lot of dynamics to, you know, the whole retro computing and collecting computers and... So, you know, we just had a meeting at the Atlanta Historical Computing Society yesterday, so that is fresh, just going to my club meeting and, you know, being around a small group of other like-minded people. And it tends to break down into two main groups, though. There's more dynamics in this, but there are the people that like the retro game, and gaming's a big theme. And then there's the hardware hackers. And I think it's inevitable biggest comparisons I've always made to collecting computers is vintage cars, which is not exactly the same thing, but there's some similarities there, but maybe like people that collect old televisions and old radios. But I think hardware is just going to go away at some point. There'll be, it's just because it's all going to break. It's all going to sort of rot away at some point. And there's only so much restoration, so much you can do, you know. And so, yes, it's inevitable that a Commodore 64 10, 20, 30, 50 years from now is going to become more and more rare. Because the fact of the matter, they just get, once they stop working, they just get trashed. They are, you know, 20 years ago when I first started this, an old computer was garbage. And that, and a lot, some people, more people realize it's not garbage nowadays, but there's still people that this is worthless, you know. But, yeah, like this computer here, this Tandy 1000, it's not worth a lot of money, but it has some value now. So it's just now, I mean, I don't know, top of my head, $50, $100 maybe. Maybe it's a functioning system with a matching display and stuff. Maybe a little over $100. Not a lot, but, you know, I mean, 10 years ago, it was trash. It was, you know, someone would happily give it away. But I think that's the thing about computers, the digital aspect of it. So especially gaming, but even any old software and through emulation, that part of it can live on forever because you can, you know, you can run software on emulators. You don't have to have the real hardware anymore. So I think it just starts breaking down. I think it'll always exist. And in fact, retro gaming, I think, is growing, it seems to me.
I agree.
It's kind of getting bigger and bigger. And even like my 10-year-old son loves old games. So he's even nostalgic for stuff from his, you know, not that long ago, but stuff pre-himself, you know, pre-his own childhood and stuff, like his older brother and older sister. So that's kind of neat. So, but it's inevitable the hardware just goes away. Do you see
things like, you know, that Altair clone that just came out? That's a functional clone, not necessarily a complete physical clone, but it has the distinct appearance of an Altair 8800, has the switches and the lights, and there was a lot of care taken to make sure that it functions identically. Do you see that sort of thing maybe being developed for, I don't know, a Commodore 64 or an Apple II or something like that?
I do too. Yeah,
I'd say at some point in the future where it pretty much becomes impractical to buy a real one or to repair it yourself. I mean, I don't have the skill and I don't really have the money to get a real Altair 8800. So that was the perfect thing for me, to get one that from the outside, it is an Altair 8800. It is an authentic Altair 8800. Granted, it's emulated on the inside. It's empty on the inside. It's not real S100 and motherboard and all that kind of stuff. So, I think there's going to be a lot more of that going forward. So I know, Jeff, you said so too. So, yeah, I think we'll see. I know we had that one Commodore 64 where it's just the case was made to look like the real thing, I guess, kind of inlay. But I think we'll see more of those.
That's true. There was from Commodore USA. They had that.
But the time's got to be around the corner for an Apple II, you know, work-alike or, you know, clone.
Maybe Franklin will come back.
But I think it's going to grow. I mean, I think obviously we've seen it. You know, it is growing slowly. You know, it's a niche hobby, though, absolutely.
It is. And I don't know that it will. I mean, if I had to place a bet on it, I don't think that it would ever be more than a niche hobby. But I think there's an interesting confluence now between the hobbyists and the people who are more formal about preserving history, like the museums. Like, it's kind of interesting that in a lot of other cases, I'm not sure that there is this such a close linkage between the hobbyist community and the actual formal preservation community. But in retro computing, you know, like the Living Computer Museum, they're out there on Twitter, they're interacting with a lot of the people who do this as a hobby, and it's an interesting symbiotic relationship. So
I like what I'm seeing from them. They follow me on Twitter, so. And sometimes retweet stuff, and I think that's cool and everything, you know, where the Computer History Museum's a little more bigger organization and formalized and everything.
Right.
Not to put them down, but I mean, just...
No, they're at a different spot on the continuum.
They seem more of a traditional, you know, museum or whatever.
Yep.
Institution, that's the word I was looking for.
Yes, it is an institutional approach with a curated and... you know, as much care as could possibly be taken to preserve the original nature of the artifact. And I find the whole thing fascinating. I'm just, where I think it might be, I kind of agree with Jeff that in 5 years it won't be too much different. I really am curious, it's fuzzy for me, where the retro computing hobby is going to be in 20 years from now. It's why I like to ask people what their thoughts are, because to me, I just... Yeah, I mean, there are those questions, like right now we've got gigabit Ethernet and high-speed wireless, and we think, wow, this is all really cool, but 20 years from now that'll be quaint and archaic, and so will people be trying to dig through their closet to see if they can find those old, ancient gigabit Ethernet cards, or...
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
But I think though also you'll find people digging out their, you know, iPhone 1s and their, you know, T-Mobile G1 Android phone, you know, the first, you know, smartphones, if you will, Blackberries, and, you know, there's certainly going to be a collecting area around that, and then, you know, tablets, mm-hmm. you know, and then what else is in the future? So, yeah, and desktop computers are going to, for the most part, kind of, I don't think they're going to completely ever go away, but they're going away, you know, pretty quickly here. So that, even
they're
a desktop computer,
share.
Yeah, it's going to become sort of a oddity, you know, interesting collectible, I think, you know.
Yep.
But I remember, you might remember, like, you know, when I first started, the IBM PC and AT, and they were all over the place, and all the clones and stuff. You can't hardly find those anymore. And they go for $100-$200 on eBay, just some generic 286 clone now.
They do. I got that Intel 386 that's an actual Intel-manufactured PC, and mm-hmm. I felt so lucky that a friend of mine gave that to me, because it, yeah, if I wanted to go out and try and find something like that, they're pricey.
Yeah.
So.
But, you know, as far as, just to close it out, I guess, is I don't think, you know, as far as things like the Apple One, you know, things that are real valuable,
mm-hmm.
you know, other, I don't think there's too many of those floating around. I mean, the next closest thing is what, like an Apple Lisa One, maybe, and then one of the earliest Apple Twos. Those are some probably the most Altairs, and that's about it, really. There's nothing, everything else kind of drops the values about anything.
The Commodore 65 prototype is still pretty valuable, too, because there's only a few dozen of those.
And I imagine if someone had a complete, what is it, the B-series Commodore. I know there's one that sold recently, but, you know, someone that has a functioning one that's all complete and stuff, I'm sure that's pretty valuable.
Those are not quite as much as the 65, but...
No.
But it is
nice.
But you
don't see the monitors that match very often.
Right. Those kind of cool... futuristic.
Kind of, yeah, rounded in the back and stuff.
Yeah. All right. Well, I appreciate you guys' thoughts on that. I guess we better move on. David, you had something about a video game book that was coming out.
So last show, we had, turned out to just be me and Sid Bolton.
I noticed that. Carrington, what, had a power outage or something?
Yeah, right. So so we had another guest co-host on, and then Carrington wasn't ultimately able to make it. And so he mentioned, so Sid mentioned on the show, and Sid runs the Personal Computer Museum in Canada. I'm trying to think of the name of the town. Don't have it handy. Wait, here it is. No, I don't see it. Anyway, so he'd mentioned that he's working on a book and he couldn't really announce it. Well, he's announced it. Oh, here it is. He's in Brantford, Ontario, Canada. That's where the Personal Computer Museum is. So here's just a link to an article about it. So it's a new video game book. It's called Collecting for Dragon's Lair and Space Ace. So I just wanted to mention that, since he had mentioned it, couldn't give any details last time. But it's coming out on July 24th, and it's going to be $30. And it's 170 pages, full color. So this is a book if you're a big fan of Dragon's Lair and Space Ace. And I know that, I don't know a lot about the history of that. Maybe you guys can fill in. I know that the artist, I believe, wasn't he like a former Disney artist or something. He was like
Don
a real...
Yeah,
there you go. That's the name, Don Bluth. He was like a famous cartoonist, and he did the, you know, the art for that. I know the whole gaming machine was a real... Wasn't it laser disc based? And it was just a real unique and sort of a breakthrough sort of gaming system. Do you guys know about that? I think it was laser disc based, and it had
I used to fix video games back at the time that those were out in the early 80s.
Yeah,
I worked for a company nearby that did regional service for Tilt Arcade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and when the laser disc came out, it's like, this is pretty interesting. You know, we have this big disc that you can, you know, big disc player. It was new to me, even though Laserdisc had been around for a while. But it was interesting how they can just, you know, have the motion video in the background coming off this disc and then have a computer controlling, you know, the action and any overlays that, well, Space Ace and Dragon's Lair didn't have any overlays in that sense, but the future Laserdisc games had graphic overlays, like Astron Belt and stuff like that, and I thought, oh, this is the future. This has got to be the future because we have all this high-quality, you know, graphics going on, you know, quote graphics.
Yeah, the only thing I remember, so I was not a big fan of, which one was first? Dragon's Lair was the first one, wasn't it? Yeah. So I wasn't a big fan because all I remember was, wow, that looks pretty cool and stuff, and I watched other people play it, and when I tried to play it, it was way too hard. So just eight quarters, and it's like, okay, I'm not trying this anymore. And then I remember it was so slow between the scenes. There was always that lag between it loading the scenes, which wasn't too big of a deal. It just was way too hard, I thought. So, and also, it wasn't really a traditional video game in the sense of, you know, full control. You're moving something around.
You pay to learn a pattern. That's what it was.
Yeah. So I was, you know, big fan of the gameplay itself. So I remember it. It was a big deal when it hit the arcades.
Yeah, I remember seeing it. I remember everybody was, lots of eye candy because of the, you know, that incredible quality of the video.
So it should be an interesting book.
Yeah.
I assume it was a very successful game. I'm not sure, but I guess it was.
I don't know that answer. I
have to get the book.
The book will tell you.
Into behind the scenes.
What's that?
I'm sorry. Intended to go behind the scenes of Dragon's Lair and Space Ace.
Oh, the book itself?
Yeah.
He's exhaustively aggregated and annotated virtually every Dragon's Lair Space Ace video game and merchandise known to modern man.
Okay.
So, let's see. Radio.
So it's the outside the cabinet type view instead of inside the cabinet view.
Yeah. Yep, that's what it seems to be. It's for the collector. So, yeah, it's in a series called Collecting For.
Okay.
So, yeah, so it doesn't really go into some of those other topics of...
So if there was a Dirk Daring stuffed doll, you know, it would tell you about that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, cool. Well, I hope the book does well. So, Jeff, what this thing, Google, I've heard of them.
I'm sorry, I missed that here.
What? Google? I've heard of them. What?
Google.
Yeah. What are they powering? They power a lot of stuff. They power Hangouts, which I have to, you know, try and re-navigate every time. But they're powering something else here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's my segue cue that I completely missed, isn't it? Yeah, they are.
No worries.
They are actually They're getting with the Cambridge Computer Initiative to develop programs to teach kids how to program a computer. And what I thought was interesting about it is they're not sitting them down in front of, like, you know, Microsoft Visual Studio and saying, here, have at it. Actually, it'd be great if they were just sitting them down in front of Eclipse in the Android development environment. But what they're doing is they're taking it back even further, which goes back to what we were talking about, you know, classic and vintage computers, what good are they for? They're using, well, since it's in the UK, they're using BBC Micros to teach kids how to program in BASIC first and then lead them all the way up to programming, like, on the Raspberry Pi environment, if you're familiar with that. And I thought it was quite interesting that, okay, let's teach kids how they were when they programmed, even though it might not be fun, it might be a bit kitschy, or it might be fun for a few moments, but will teach a child the stuff that maybe most of us have already dealt with, is when you're typing in a BASIC program, it's long, drawn out, a bit arduous, and then you just cross your fingers that it's going to work because you mistyped something and it's not working properly. You got to go back and learn to troubleshoot that without any of the modern-day object-oriented capabilities that we have now, like being able to just move out whole sections of code, try something, and then move that code back in again to find out where the problems are. So they're kind of bridging the gap between vintage computing or classic computing and modern-day computing from a programming standpoint.
That's awesome. It's interesting that they're taking that approach. I mean, I had toyed around with that approach, and we'd gone a ways, my daughter and I, teaching her about computers and computer programming. And I mean, my family knows I'm into this weird computer stuff because they come down in the basement, you know, our family room is filled with it. So, but she was showing an interest in computers, and I thought, let's go from where they were to where they are, and we'll take our time and kind of go through the progression. And it seemed to be working for her. That Google is doing it is just, I don't know, I think that's kind of awesome.
Did your daughter ever play with Scratch?
Yeah. Yeah,
that
in fact.
That helped my son a lot.
We had one of the, for a while, we had one of the one laptop per child computers.
Oh, yeah, and the little thing with the green antennas.
Uh-huh. And Scratch was actually a built-in program on there for teaching about computing.
To learn all the constructs and stuff. Yeah, it works out great for that.
Also, I think that they talked about that at my kids' elementary school as well. I think the computers that they sat them down with in the learning center had Scratch, and they were able to poke around with that a bit.
Yeah, I was surprised how well even Scratch grew. My son started doing an awful lot with it, but I noticed a lot of the programs that came from it were basically, let's have some moving things on screen and throw 6 minutes of MP3 music on top of it, and that call that a Scratch program. So some people lost track of what it was for, and other people really went to work and tweaked as much functionality out of it and created some very useful Scratch programs.
Learn some logic, and yeah.
Yeah, Scratch bridges that gap really well, and when I saw, you know, this article, I'm thinking, well, they probably use Scratch there. In fact, I think the article even mentions it. But I like the fact that they're not throwing people down with just brand new stuff and saying, here, learn this. They're giving kids a retrospect on what it was like. And I think, I don't know, give me your opinion. Do you think that if somebody's learning to program that they should learn to do it the old-fashioned way first to get a basic understanding or even an appreciation about programming? And if so, does that define a good programmer, somebody who's able to, you know, program with limited resources like we used to do back in the day?
I think there are two sides to the coin. Some people feel that if you learn basic first, then you are scarred for life because you've learned spaghetti code first, and then you can't make your mind work in an object-oriented or a structured way. I don't particularly agree with that, but a lot of people feel that way.
Well, that's happened to me. I experienced that, but I got over it eventually.
Yeah, I mean, you know, coming from programming in the 70s and 80s, when I started out, BASIC and Fortran were the things that we were poking around with, eventually Pascal at my college. And so I had to kind of jump that hurdle too. I think one of the problems with the modern environments is they're so hard to boil down. They're very powerful, but you talked about Eclipse and Android, or maybe just Eclipse and Java, say, for instance, or on the Microsoft side, the Visual Studio. To learn the .NET framework or to learn the Java frameworks could be a lifetime job. And so can you really boil that down to Hello World so that somebody can feel it's approachable and get started? Whereas if you start on one of the old retro computers, you can make the thing do some simple things pretty fast. You can never make it do complex things like you could with a full-fledged Java environment or .NET environment, but you could at least get it to do something without having to have a PhD. So, I don't know. I think you could argue that from both sides.
Yeah, it's like abstracting it through like the .NET architecture and the Java stuff, abstracting programming from the hardware level, which is basically what it does. You know, makes things easier, but at the same time, it makes it difficult because you really don't know what's going on behind the scenes. And if something major is happening, how do you address that? You know, how can you fix a problem or at least achieve a goal that is difficult to achieve because some problem came up in the middle of writing your program? You want to do something as efficiently as possible. Yeah, you can program against an API and do it the way the API has you do it. But if you can't go in a little bit, just you know, one step below,
and then everybody's a programmer.
Effective programming.
API. I know what it means. Not everybody knows what all this stuff means.
Yeah. Application programmer interface, the programmer's view of platform world. Yeah, we'll just find it for folks. But
I'm sorry, I was talking shop there. So.
So how about I give my non-programmer's opinion?
Yeah.
Because I'm not a programmer at all. So
yeah, what do you think?
Well, I was thinking of a car analogy, which isn't perfect either. No, there's never really perfect analogies, but I think you got to have. I think you don't have to know how to work on a 1974 Datsun, which I used to have one, real simple, engine, right, to be able to work on a brand new engine. But you do have to have some basis of understanding how things work, and you have to, So I think you need to know as much backwards as applicable to what you're working on. So for instance, if I need to learn how to repair a modern fuel-injected, system, I don't necessarily need to know how a four-barrel carburetor works. Is that a good analogy? Or
no, actually, that sounds pretty good.
But the basics of how they both work, there's some similarities there of what they're doing, shooting a gas-air mixture into the engine, pistons or whatever. So, so I think you have to. I just think you have to go as far down as is applicable to what you're doing. So it depends on what you're doing.
And had you started with that 74 or with my 68 Cougar,
it's probably easier to build up to it, yeah.
The way I feel is it gives you an intuition. I think that we've got a lot of excellent software engineers out in the field today, and I think they do excellent work by and large. But I think in a lot of cases, there's an intuition there that is lacking because what's going on under the hood, I think this is what both of you are alluding to, what's going on under the hood is mysterious.
It's magical, yeah.
Yeah,
there's no substitute for knowing how the basics, at the most basic level, of how an engine works. It sure is helpful when you want to start troubleshooting it, of what's wrong,
Right. So. Well, I'm gonna move us along. That was a great conversation. I hate to leave it, but we have to for the sake of time. So I got a link from Ken Gagne, who shot us some information about an article. It's one of those slideshow articles, which I kind of like sometimes because they're bite-sized and easy to eat. This one is on networkworld.com, and it's about 10 cool analog computers. And we've briefly mentioned analog computers on the show before. If you go look at this article, and of course we'll have a link in the show notes, you can see pictures and a little explanation about 10 analog computers that were out there that were important in the computing world. But I have to admit that from my perspective, and this is a hole in my understanding of computing history, I'm still fuzzy on how you would use an analog computer. I mean, yeah. I guess you set some knobs and dials, and then you pump some voltages into it, and it does some comparisons maybe with some amplifiers or differential stuff, and then
was
comes out.
Was the original Pong game an analog computer?
I don't know that answer.
The one that, Bear, not the one he created, but the one before that was done on an oscilloscope, I think it was actually 100% analog. And it controlled a moving object on an oscilloscope screen, which is an analog measuring device. So that's how I can relate to an analog computer doing something. It's not digitizing the process and then coming up with an output in analog format. It's just making the input change the output directly.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And they mention in the article, and also when I went over to Wikipedia to look up analog computing, that because it's not digital, you're dealing with approximations, and there are advantages and disadvantages to that. I mean, the advantage is that if you're trying to model phenomenon in the real world, then that is always an approximation. You can know that something is moving at about 10 miles per hour, but you are unlikely to know that it's moving at 10.172906 miles per hour. You know what I mean? I mean, it's about
read, right?
Exactly. It's about 10 miles per hour. So they were used heavily in industrial, mechanical, that kind of thing, and apparently also for military, calculating bomb trajectories and that kind of stuff. So I found the article to be an interesting read. I just thought I'd pass it along.
Okay. Yeah, it's cool.
I like the name of this one. It says, The Computer Mark One. More basic than that.
David, there is some fun on the horizon, and I think I added one here for you to talk about, actually.
Yeah, you did.
The Convex. So
I put it in order.
Where can people congregate and see vintage computers and talk about vintage computers?
So just quickly put together a quick list of what's upcoming. So we already know Carrington's on his way to Kansas Fest. And Kansas Fest officially starts in 2 days on the 23rd.
Woohoo!
So and it goes till the 28th, which I think is Sunday, isn't it? Or Saturday? Anyway, it's 5 days. Mm-hmm. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Okay. So it ends on Sunday. So anyway, Karen is on his way there. So this is Kansas Fest. And I believe this is their 30th anniversary, isn't it? Yeah, I should find out these things for right now.
That sounds familiar.
I think it is. Anyway, go to kansasfest.org and you can find out. So that is the immediate upcoming show this next week. And then the one you added, Earl, which thank you, I had missed this, is Convex, which is the Commodore Vegas Expo. And it happens just like a week later getting there. So it starts on July, so I'm assuming it's a weekend, July 27th and July 28th.
Yep.
And that's in Las Vegas. And this is pretty much the biggest Commodore show in the country, right?
I think so. Hard to know in terms of, you know, attendees, but this has been a very popular one. I've noticed it's where if there's new stuff coming out for the Commodore, people try to, it's almost like the CES days, people try to hack it together for this show. And this is their 9th go-round. I can't believe it's been going on for this long. Robert Bernardo, the guy who puts this together, has been doing this for a long time. So, fun.
Yeah, so that is just, you know, that's a week from now it starts, or week from yesterday. Gosh, I got to get my numbers right. So it's a week from now, week from yesterday. Mm-hmm. So what it starts anyway. So, okay, so then moving forward just into the future. So, okay, next we have the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest 8.0 and the Emergency Chicagoland Commodore Convention. And that is happening, let me get over to the link. There's two links here because they both have a page. So that is in September. It's the end of September on the 28th and 29th. And that's outside of Chicago in Lombard. And for our longtime listeners, you might remember, I went to, I guess it was 6 I went to, so almost 2 years ago. And Bill Degnan was also there from March. And he joined the show that time.
Two events in one now?
Yeah, it has been for, I guess is the third year?
Yeah, I'm just curious, is that happening a lot more often now, as opposed to having separate events where we're finding maybe people aren't showing up or there's not a lot of attendance, now we're mixing these events?
I'm not aware of any other ones offhand, necessarily, but are you, Earl? I know VCF is standalone, and unfortunately, the other VCF, the Southeast one, it was canceled this year, so there's not one, and I don't know if it'll happen again. That was the one in Arlington, Texas, and
you almost did a combination event, David. I mean, it was. I don't know. What do you think? The thing with the Apple pop-up museum and your VCF.
It was one event. It was not supposed to be a combo event. So, yes, but I guess it turned into sort of a combo thing. But that was not the intent.
Gotcha.
So
back to where is retro computing going to be in the next 5 years? You know, we have these events that help keep it alive.
Yeah, I mean, I think what they're doing is a good thing. I don't see any problem with it. Why not? Why not?
Oh, I love them. I just wish there was something closer to me.
Yeah, more inclusive and, you know. But, you know, me, myself anyway, as far as computer history stuff goes, I'm all inclusive anyway. Even though, I'm an Apple person, I guess, primarily, and a Macintosh person. I say just have one big... I'm not so big on the Apple-only shows and Commodore-only shows and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm a big Commodore fan, and I'd love to go to Kansas Fest sometime.
Yeah, so nothing against Kansas Fest or the Commodore show, and it's, but I'd say why not invite everybody, and if it just turns out it's stronger one area over the other.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, okay, so getting back to it. But yeah, I mean, I guess the VCFSC was... it was sort of a, I mean, you know, it was a great event. An Apple pop-up museum was amazing. It looked like a real museum. But, you know, Lonnie Mims doesn't listen to our show. And I'll just tell you that it wasn't really supposed to be that way. The Apple pop-up museum was supposed to be right in the middle of the VCF SE. So a little bit of a sore point.
Gotcha. But it kind of stole the show in some ways.
Yeah. Which is, you know, cool. But anyway, so that's coming up in September. And then also March, the Mid-Atlantic Retro, I always get this, computer history enthusiasts, I always get messed up. The guys in New Jersey, so VCF East, they have announced a date for their show, which just happens to be around the time when the next VCF SE should be happening. So anyway, it's in April, so April 5th and 6th. And if things go to plan, the next VCF SE would be roughly, you know, a year from this last one, so it'll be around that time, too.
Now, that one's close to me. I should be going to that one.
Yeah, and of course, you know, they had to cancel the one this year, so that's what they're calling it 9.1. And so that should be a big show.
Yeah, that's typically true. And that's typically a real popular one.
Yeah. It does well. And that's it, I think, right?
I think that's it.
There's lots of other smaller stuff going on, but those are the primary bigger shows, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad that we got the 911 or the 411 or the whatever it is on that. Jeff, computer chess. So when I worked in computer retail, we had the Franklin chess game machines. I just loved those things. They were great. So it looks like you've got an article about...
Well, this one was pretty interesting. It's basically a mockumentary. It's like an indie movie that was created. It's a mockumentary about depicting geeks or nerds or whatever politically correct term you want to use, what they may have done in the late 70s trying to program chess playing algorithms. And so this movie, which apparently hasn't been released yet, or they just had a showing in one spot right now, I'm hoping they release it in some way, shape, or form to the public.
Computer chess, right? In the movie?
It was active portrayal of computer geeks, and they would depict them going to these chess tournaments and playing computer against computer, trying to show off their best computer playing or chess playing algorithms. And it was filmed using what was basically state-of-the-art cameras from 1970, a particular Sony camera, to give it that real look, like somebody in the mid-70s had this old camera lying around and wanted to, you know, shoot this movie. So it's a mockumentary, you know, like some of those Apple ones that are out there to talk about
Spinal Tap. Oh, yeah.
It looks very interesting. And I don't know how much truth went into it, but it still shows what somebody may have done or what people may have done with computers back in the day and how they would have gone about using them.
It looks like they're using some real old technology. I mean, just on this first page, I recognize a couple of the things that I'm seeing, and it's interesting that they use that old camera technology to film this. That would give it that old 70s style look for the film. When you say mockumentary, do you mean that they're, in a sense, making fun of the people who were involved in this?
I think it's based partially on truth, but a mockumentary, it's probably not like the real people at the time that did this, and they're going through, you know, looking at somebody's history.
Well, I see what you mean.
It's a movie made to seem like a documentary.
Yes. As if this was buried in the annals of time, and they just recently dug it up and blew the dust off of it and playing it to everybody.
It's playing in a number of theaters close to me. It looks to be a pretty mainstream movie. It's been playing in all the theaters near where I live. And I put a quick link to Rotten Tomatoes on the show notes when we post that. So it's getting good reviews.
And I like the little write-up of all the different computers that were available at the time that this, you know, movie supposedly took place. So you see all these ads and little details about some of the computers and where they, you know, what they were used for and, you know, what's the fate of them. Like they have the PDP-11, some ads there, Commodore PET, the MSI 8080. These would be the kind of computers they would have used to try to create a computer algorithm. and pit them against other computers. You know, could the K Pro 2 work better than the MSI for programming computer algorithms, or was it person against person, but they're using their computers, their programming knowledge to enhance their chess playing abilities?
I don't know. I'm a Commodore enthusiast, but I think Commodore PET versus PDP-11.
Yeah.
The Commodore loses that match.
here's a quick review. It says, this profound, peculiar work of genius, this half-comic portrait of the present and embryo within the past, anyway, reverberates with hidden meanings and a questing intelligence. And then here's a negative one. A punitively dull chunk of cork that is about and feels like being stuck in a motel with the gaggle of programming nerds for a weekend.
Now, see, being stuck with a group of programming nerds for
that
a weekend...
That could be good or bad, right?
That's not purgatory for me. Actually,
wait, isn't that Kansas Fest?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. But that's a whole week.
Yeah.
That's good. Well, cool. Well, thank you for pointing this out. I actually want to see this now.
Yeah, me too.
I got to find out when and where.
Yeah. So, speaking of being stuck with programming nerds, Retro Challenge, the twice a year. Yeah, it's halfway done, actually, right? The 21st?
Yeah, so, 3/4 of the way done.
And lots of fun stuff is happening. So I just send people over to retrochallenge.net so that you can see what's going on. I mean, there's Jeff,
you'll
you mentioned
you're
stuff. Yeah, you're doing something for that,
yep.
Right? Tell us about your deal.
I am getting a TI-99 computer, complete system, including the expansion box and the disk drive. Stuff I had in my collection I didn't use for a long time. I'm getting it up and running, cleaned out, and I'm actually going to put it to some sort of use. Basically, I'm halfway done. I have it all together, I have it running, things are tested. My next phase, I'll be video recording myself doing things with it. I got some software that I have to figure out how to run it because the TI-99 was really weird in running applications. You always had to jump through hoops to do the simplest things, which probably reason why the TI-99... you know, didn't last as long as it could have because it was a very powerful computer. But I have Microsoft Multiplan, I have word processors for it, games, of course, and I even have an editor assembler. I can, you know, learn to program in what chip is it, TI-99 something. I forget what it was. Yeah, I should know more about this. But I can see if
it was
I
that 16-bit.
16-bit, yeah, but it's run like through an 8-bit bus, so
right.
It's one of the reasons why it was so slow. But it had excellent graphics. Atari made great use of it with their the cartridges that they made, the Atari Soft cartridges. I mean, it has a wonderful Burger Time, Donkey Kong games. They all look great, but the user could not get that kind of power out of the computer without investing a lot of money. Even to get a disk directory, you have to stick in another cartridge called Disk Manager, and then run that, print it out to a printer if you're lucky enough to have one, and refer to it later so you know what programs are on it.
Are you finding that the retro? I mean, this is what a couple times when I've dove in for the Retro Challenge. Well, it was either guilt and crash and burn failure, or it was, wow, that was a really good incentive for me to get going on that project. Is that kind of how you feel about it?
Well, I mean for the Retro Challenge itself?
Or? Yeah, for the Retro Challenge.
Yeah, the past two Retro Challenges, I put my dog in the game, but I didn't get anywhere with it. I didn't really have time, or I didn't have it... a real good direction with what I wanted to do. So I wanted to do something specific before. Now it's like I have stuff that I'm not using, and I want to use it. I want to see how it works. I never turned it on before, so that was my challenge, is to get it up and running, become familiar with it, and do the most that I can with it during the month that the Retro Challenge is going on. And so far I'm on track, and I'm having fun with it too. Now I know my stuff works.
Nice. Yeah, I can't wait to see the video. Like I was mentioning before the show started.
I got two previews out there right now on YouTube.
Oh, cool.
I've been sending previews out. But I'm still editing together, which will probably be one of my longest videos, you know, when I'm finally finished. I expect it to be about an hour long, you know, just enough to bore people.
Yeah, it'd be fun to see a TI all tricked out like that. You know, usually when you see them these days, it's just the console. So.
What's more is I have two more of these boxes stored away that I don't know what their condition is. So if I get this one working, at least I know I have spare parts.
The expansion chassis.
Yes.
Wow.
You won't believe this. I bought this in 95, 96 at a yard sale. I bought three chassis, a bunch of the computers. I got a whole bunch of cartridges and a box full of diskettes for $15.
Wow. You know, those expansion chassis, they don't give those away on eBay these days.
No, because for one thing, it's a fortune to ship them. They're like 40 or 50 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the biggest thing. Going back to our first topic that's changed in eBay is how expensive, it's not their fault, I guess, how much shipping is now for everything.
Right.
Man, shipping's really gone up a lot.
Post office needs their piece.
It's always nice when you can find something local.
Yeah, last thing I need to do is I got the serial port that I didn't fully test. I'm going to hook it up to a modem and dial up a bulletin board. They're still out there. But I'll be doing it 300 baud.
Very, very good. Yeah, there are still, and I think even more popping up. I don't know if it's because people are setting up VoIP accounts and, you know, having that come in or whatever.
Yeah, but it works over VoIP. That's what I'm doing. And I can get up to about 9,600 baud steady. Anything faster, it depends on the quality. But I've done with my Commodore Amiga, I've hooked it up. And I can do about 9,600 baud through a Vonage account, which is VoIP. And it works pretty well.
Yeah, anything faster than that, the A to D to A to D stuff is just going to kill you. Right?
Not even a phone limitation, that's correct.
Right. So, David, why don't you close us out? The Jobs movie is coming to the theaters. Is that the Jobs with the little J movie?
Yes, right. And it was called iJobs, I guess, a few months ago, and then they suspended its release and whatever the deal was. Remember, it was supposed to originally come out right the same weekend the VCFSC was opening. Mm-hmm. So that was April 20th or April 19th or something. On that Friday, I think, it was supposed to open. And then they abruptly canceled it like a few weeks out. Anyway, so it's called Jobs now, with just a lowercase J and capital OBS, with Ashton Kutcher as Steve Jobs. And so there's an official trailer out now. And it's opening on August 16th. And then there's a link to the official, it's thejobsmovie.com. It's nothing there yet. It says coming soon. And then it's at Rotten Tomatoes, though, so it's gotten some reviews. Boy, some of the official reviewers, it's only been a few, though. They've given it 43%, so that means it's rotten.
Ouch. So
Wiley played a better Jobs, huh?
Some of the scenes in the trailer and stuff I've seen Ashton Kutcher in, I mean, at least from there, it looks like he does a pretty good job. And anyway, you can read some of these reviews. Obviously, as we get closer, you'll get more. I will go see it. I'm kind of burnt out now on the whole thing. I mean,
there's been a lot of coverage of Jobs and his.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not real excited about it, but
on Netflix, if you have Netflix streaming, that's one place you can get this. There's something from Robert Cringely, the Lost Steve Jobs interview,
which is, I think, overall the best thing you could watch.
I loved that. I just actually saw that a couple days ago, believe it or not, and. I don't know what took me, but anyway, I thought that was some fantastic history going right there, and Steve Jobs was surprisingly candid, and people were noting in the comments that Bob Cringely would ask him a question, and if it was a particularly thought-provoking question, then Jobs would kind of sit there for just a few seconds and think about it before he didn't feel like he had to jump right out and answer it right off the bat. You know, it's like he wanted to ponder it a little bit first, which is the sign of a thoughtful response. So,
but we'll see how this movie goes. And it's if you're into computer history and Apple, it seems to be a must see sort of movie.
I'm sure it'll be enjoyable no matter what. I mean, I know that some of the stuff in Pirates is not all that historically accurate, but they get the caricatures right. It's a fun movie.
That was a good movie overall.
Yeah.
Because maybe you haven't seen the Pirates of Silicon Valley movie, see that. too. So yeah, get you hyped up for the, you know, for the new movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Pirates was interesting. I had forgotten the name there. That's the movie I was thinking about earlier.
Yeah, that's
the
that
one where Noah Wiley played Steve Jobs, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
And then later he went to Macworld, and he actually walked out on... Have you ever seen that? YouTube and watched that.
That
he actually walked
so
out
great
on stage.
People don't know for a few seconds that it's not
right,
really
right.
Steve Jobs.
Yeah. So cool. I remember watching that live. That was... I want to say that was 98, maybe? So, and, you know, and there was a time when Apple would stream the keynotes, and then they stopped for a long time after that. Not after that one particularly, necessarily, but...
They
but
are doing it again,
that.
Though, now, right? The
I think, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, they have been for a few years now. I don't always watch them now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to watch the keynotes.
Nobody's going to make you. It's a free country.
Yeah.
How do you like your computer to become a warm, friendly, hard-working member of your family? How'd you like to see your kids spend more time on the computer than on the phone? Whether you're about to buy your first computer or want the one you have to really help solve problems, save time, money, and be lots of fun, subscribe to Family Computing Magazine from Scholastic, the people who've made learning fun for almost 65 years.
From the day we started shopping for our computer, Family Computing's been with us all the way.
It's the only magazine written especially to help families get the most out of their computer.
Family Computing, the one magazine that makes computing come alive for the whole family. Hundreds of money-saving reviews and previews on every kind of software and hardware, from the latest word on word processing to monitors, modems, and music. Add-ons to jazz up your system, like a good color printer for less than $200. We introduce you to every kind of language, give you dozens of original programs for every major computer brand, show you how to learn more, earn more, save more, with monthly features like our Home School Connection, Home Money Management, and Home Business Tips, so adults and kids can learn everything from writing a report to writing a song. Plus, every issue has K-Power, a special kids section full of extra programs, games, and contests. Get 1 year, 12 reader-friendly issues for just $15.97. You save 52% off the cover price. And you'll get not one, but two free gifts. The best of Family Computing programs, the ones our readers love the most, plus amazing games, both free.
Whether you're a beginner or a whiz, your whole family will love Family Computing. Call now!
I have to come up with a retro computing gift idea.
Oh, yeah. What'd you come up with?
So there's a book that I checked out from the library, actually, and read some of the chapters of, and it has gotten great reviews. Here's the thing. There's also this symbiotic relationship between people interested in retro computing and people interested in the kind of burgeoning maker movement, where you build electronics hobbyist kind of things, or you, I don't know, make a new peripheral for your old retro computer, but you build it with an Arduino or with a propeller or something like that. So
yeah, I do that stuff too. It's fun.
It is. It's great. Or with the Raspberry Pi, like you were talking about earlier, Jeff. And I really enjoy that, but I found that where my digital electronics is actually pretty sound and I get it, my analog electronics sometimes really could use a little help. Like, I don't know why you put capacitors in this particular place in a circuit to smooth out the voltage and not this other place. You know, I just, things like when you lay out a circuit board, trying to make sure you don't get crosstalk between the traces, I have no clue why you do that or why you don't. And so I wanted to just bootstrap myself a little bit in electronics, and this book was one of the things that I thought could help me. And again, it's gotten really good reviews, so you can get it on Amazon. What is it for the actual soft cover?
Oh, I think it was
2203.
Yeah,
but
it
I noticed that there's also a Kindle edition now, which I don't know that there was that before for $9.80. I think I'm gonna buy it because
people are arguing that the Kindle version doesn't have the table of contents.
Ooh. Well, why not, I wonder? Huh.
Well, you know, just to point out another thing, too. In this case, it's not a big money difference, especially if you have Prime. Because so it's $22.03, and if you have Prime, it's free shipping, and it's like two-day shipping. But what I always do anytime I go to Amazon, if you look down, you know, at the used, I mean, sometimes you can find a used version that's in very good condition, so it's like new. And granted, it's from a private deal seller, so you'll pay shipping, but you can save, you know, $5-$10 or more that way.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to. I mean, if you, you know, why not? Sitting on the book you're going after. That's usually the cheapest way to get them.
One of the other things about this book is that there are companies who sell, like, if you read this book, they will give you a shopping list for chapters 1 through whatever. And so you go out and you buy these LEDs or a battery or, you know, a little photo cell or something in order to do the exercises. But if you look, I think either on eBay or you can find them, I'm pretty sure, on Amazon, other places, you'll find that people have kitted these parts together for you. So if you're going through this book, you can, and you want convenience, you can just go to one of these places that kitted this stuff out and buy the kits. And the kits in their totality are more expensive than the book, but it's nice that people have put them together for you and make it easy for you to go find them. So in any event, if you want to start out with electronics, if you're a vintage computer hobbyist and you're going, wow, I'd really like to build some of my own stuff and kick it old school, then this book is one good place to start.
I like the one review on this. It says, many other books introduce the subject of electronics by talking about the early discoveries concerning amber rods, Leyden jars, and static electricity. And a lot of them are like that, and it's like, wow, you can only read that so many times, but I like how this book is listed, how it's laid out, where, yeah, as you were saying, you have a parts list, which is good. Anybody who wants to get this book is obviously wants to get into it right away, and it appears all the other reviews are saying that this is what you want to get it done. I may very well have my own copy bought by the end of this podcast.
I
have a degree in electronics, but this looks like a great book.
My daughter's more of a doer than, like, you know, reading, going back and doing all the theory and stuff. And that was one of the litmus tests for me. When she read through this, she's like, wow, I love this book. And so I was thinking, okay, that means it's action-oriented. Time to roll up your sleeves sort of thing.
Hey, Earl.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. Please go and skip me for the eBay. I'll be right back.
Oh,
I thought
okay.
My battery would last. It's not going to last unless I go plug it in. So I'll be right back.
Okay. Jeff, while David's off running out, have you seen any comments
on the book?
No, on our broadcast here. Do we have any?
No,
YouTube comments?
I don't know what's. I might have to actually put a URL in for the YouTube thing. It looks like
I can read
stream sources here, but I have to put in the Google URL. And honestly, as you said before. Google changes everything around. I could try to click towards the YouTube page, but I'm afraid I'm going to get, like, echoing or...
Well, let me go ahead and bring it up, and I'll try and mute.
Okay.
I'll mute my microphone real fast.
Okay, yeah, because in the Hangouts toolbox, you can specify a Google Plus or YouTube link as a source for comments. My guess is it will extract them or, you know, take the comments out of there and put it in the toolbox stream here.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm over here. I'm having a hard time finding.
We apologize to everybody who's trying to get.
Are you talking
attention.
About the show? Yeah, Earl. Yeah. If you
where,
do the
where is it?
It's not under our normal feed or whatever. It's listed. It's listed under you, Earl Evans, and it's got the logo, Retro Computing Roundtable. But it's. I had to do a search in YouTube for the Retro Computing Roundtable Show 55 to find it. So it's not listed under our normal. It must be. Associated with your other Google account or something.
The only one that I'm logged in on right now is the media account that we use for this. I'm not.
Yeah.
I don't know how it could be connected to anything else.
Wow. Yeah.
Curse you, Google!
While you're looking for that, I just bought that book.
Oh, cool.
I'll get it on Tuesday.
So you bought the physical?
The physical book. I have my workbench right beside me here, and I have plenty of electronic parts to play with. And I like the idea of Kindle books. I do that for college books and stuff, for classes I take. But for actual workbench, you know, nose to the grindstone stuff, I want to be able to flip through pages easily.
Gotcha.
You know, my daughter's birthday was yesterday, and we got her a Kindle. It's the only Kindle we have in the house, even though we have Kindle books and stuff, because, you know, we have iPads and computers. But we actually got her the basic, you know, e-ink, you know, the page white e-ink Kindle, specifically just to read from. And I got to say that I don't think I've ever spent much time actually looking at that before, and it just amazes me. You know, I know that's not new technology, but you look at the thing, and it's like you want to swear it's something printed. You know, when she opened the box, we thought it was like a sticker on there and trying to peel it off or something, because it actually had like the logo, like it was on and had the logo there. But
it's wasting your batteries, right?
But I guess because it uses so little power, if supposedly like a full charge, it'll last a month of constant use.
I thought it takes no power to hold a display.
Yeah, it's you know, so she loves it, and it's really neat. I just, you know, I hadn't really ever looked that closely at one of those displays, and it's just so amazing how the contrast of the black on the white and stuff is just amazing. You'd swear it's a printed.
Yeah, it's like looking at paper, you know, so your eyes are used to that.
So anyway, sorry to go up. It's just, I was amazed by that.
I love the look of the Kindle. It's very easy on the eyes when you're trying to read stuff. I was just
over
on
the books on like my iPad, me personally, or like through the Kindle app.
Kind of garish.
Yeah.
I was just over on the YouTube channel, and I do apologize to folks that they're having to search. Again, Google has switched this stuff around on us, and I had done it under the RCR podcast, but for some reason, we'll try and work that out before the next show comes around. But anyway, some comments. There's just some good natured
chatting.
Oh,
there won't be a next show for you, Earl.
I'm out of here. next show's the reunion show, right? We're getting the band back together.
The homecoming.
One thing that Grumpier Than Thou said is, you know, we might not be too far from being able to do something like 3D print an Apple II case or a Commodore 64 case or whatever.
Yeah.
So in terms of, if we can 3D print human organs at this point, we ought to be able to 3D print retro computers. So, but hey, you're back, David. So you want to go with the eBay stuff?
eBay, yes.
Yeah.
I picked something I stumbled on. I thought it was very cool. So check this out. It's described as a vintage CPU, S100 computer system, terminal control with Cromimco ZPU cards. Anyway, it's some type of generic, maybe it's a semi-homemade S100 machine from, I'm going to say, the later 70s. Currently, it has no bids. It's only $199. I mean, if you could get this for $200 or $300 or maybe a little bit more than that, I think this is a deal. Now, to me in Georgia, it'd be $79 shipping. That's not too bad from
Coast,
California. So shipping's reasonable. The person's been got a good reputation. Look at some of the pictures. It's got a Cromimco ZPU card in it, which is a Z80 processor. I believe it's switchable from 2 to 4 megahertz. And it's got all the basic stuff to be a functional 8-bit S100 computer. Oh, what did they say here? Didn't the power on, though. The unit does not turn on, but we were unable to make further testing. So,
part of that could be that, again, the old power supplies with those gigantic caps that you can see in the top-down pictures here, sometimes those things just need a little tender, loving care. But, I mean, you're talking about here having the chassis, the S100 motherboard.
Yeah. I'm sure you could make it work, someone who wanted to take the time and knows what they're doing. You know?
Or you could get this and you could pop in some of those S100computers.org, isn't it? Some of those... If you want to get started in that project, making your own S100 system.
But it's got wood party S100 boards.
It's got wood sides on it, and look at the unusual front panel. It has such a small little front panel, the little teeny switches and stuff. It's just really interesting. It's very unique.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I swear, I wish I had extra money. I'd really be tempted to get it. Nothing else to look at. It's just neat.
I mean, if you... Because I've looked into building a front panel like this with the switches and the lights, and it's amazing how expensive those little toggle switches are these days.
Right, right.
You could buy this for $199 and just have the box and the switches and the lights almost make it worth it.
On the back of it, you have a 3-outlet power strip, too, so it can disguise itself as that.
So anyway, I thought it was pretty neat.
That is.
Get it. Get it today.
Own it today on DVD.
So, Earl, you said you can get S100 cards still?
There is a... So I'll look up the site right here while we're at it. S100computers.org, is it? No, is it .com? Hold on. Yeah, sorry, S100computers.com. And maybe we should add a link for this in the show notes. But there's a whole group of people that are engineering and making available S100 cards today. In a lot of cases, it's just the printed circuit board and a laundry list of the components that you need to buy to put it together. But they've got a Z80-based processor card in this particular project collection. There's a 68,000 card. I think they're working on an 8386 card to go on the S100 bus, and memory cards, and
Wow. Anyway,
a variety of stuff. It's a great group of folks, and these are not for the faint of heart. I think we've mentioned before that you need some soldering capability, you need some technical troubleshooting capability to put these together. They're not just like your corner store electronics kit, but they are real S100 stuff that you can buy and build today.
And since S100 is basically a bus standard, then you can mix and match these cards to build your own computer.
To an extent, yes.
I think we might see more reproductions that way, too, down the road. You know, people making new bus, you know, the new S100 computers and cards and stuff, because that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd love to play around with that sort of thing if I didn't have to, you know, build it or do, you know, anything more than buy it, the chassis, and buy the cards and plug them in and make it work.
Yeah. Right, right.
So,
yeah, it's a time thing for me. I wouldn't mind putting it together. My soldering skills would need some brushing up. I'd probably need a nice soldering station so I didn't fry stuff when I was trying to solder it together. But I've got a couple of S100 chassis and motherboard and power supply things out in the garage. I don't know if they work. I don't know if the power supplies are going to go all smoky on me when I first power them on. But
I have an Ohio Scientific S100 system, but it's one of those things that I haven't turned it on. I was going to use it as a future retro challenge, but it comes with some cards, but I didn't realize you could still get a bunch of cards for it. And I thought, okay, well, that might be a good reason to pull that out and all 80, 90 pounds of it. Power supply in that is probably 90% of the weight.
Along those lines with the power supply and all that, Earl, and so again, I had a AHCS meeting yesterday, so Friday night, I was out here, it started raining, so I stayed inside here. But anyway, I was checking out my compact portable I've had for a long time. It's one of the earliest ones I collected, and it always worked. And anyway, I go to turn it on. First thing, boom! You know, a capacitor blew in the power supply, and smoke comes out of it.
Oh, no. I guess the good news is that's reparable. You know, I mean, you may not want to repair it, but somebody can.
Right. And I gave it away to somebody who will repair it. Or, you know, it won't get trashed, you know, but me repairing it, it's just not my... But yeah, it's inevitable, these things. It all is going to happen. It's all of them.
Yep. Well, what do you have for us on eBay, Jeff?
Well, I have something that I used to play with a long time ago in electronics class. This is a microprocessor trainer. It uses a 68,000 series or 6800 series microprocessor. Anybody who knows what Heathkit is, they've been around for a long time. They built all sorts of electronic kits, and they had their training division. And with this learning system here, you can basically program a 6800 based computer using hand assembled code that you type in hex format. It's got 6-digit LED display that gives you addressing and lets you see what it is you're typing in. You can page through your code one line at a time, kind of like the old TI calculators, the old programmable calculators. And you can interface this with external electronics, and that's what I did for my project when I used one of these in class. I actually interfaced it with I took apart a remote control for an RC truck, and using some relays and some programming, I automated the RC truck. I ran it through a pattern. It wasn't that difficult. It's just what helped me is that it's a 6800 CPU, and I'm familiar with the 6502 series from the VIC-20 and the 6510 series. So it's got the same basic opcodes or language, so to speak. So I used some of the knowledge I had in that, along with some of the electronics knowledge I've learned in class, and just had it going through a sequence of steps, closing relays, which was, causing it to move forward, left, right, reverse, an odd way of getting something to move, but it was a concept, it was a proof of concept, and, got me a grade to do that.
Very
cool. These things are still around. I'd love to get one, but they're never at the price I want to spend.
Well,
the cost of those have gone up a lot recently.
You can get that. It's similar, not exactly like this, but you can get the MicroChem from Breel Computers that is similar in concept in that you've got the keypad and the LED displays, and you hand assemble what you want to put into it, and there are interfaces for external stuff. It doesn't have a solderless breadboard little compartment like this Keithkit seems to, but
yeah.
It still is a nice way to get an old retro chip and interface some stuff with it if you're inclined.
It was fun at the time, and I see these things pop up on eBay, and if anybody wanted to know how a microprocessor worked, could use something like this, or as you mentioned, the MicroChem. I did see those. I really didn't look into them. It'd be cool to have a real Kim. Kim 1 computer?
Mm-hmm.
But the MicroChem would probably do just what I would want to do if I wanted to relive that experience, short of going Arduino, but, where's the fun in actually programming something in a development environment? Then you can just, hand assemble your code and tap it in, one opcode at a time.
Yep. So on eBay, I picked MSI 8080, and this is interesting that it doesn't have a top lid, and the person doesn't know if it works, but the opening bid was really reasonable. I can't remember what it was because now there are a couple bids on it, but the shipping also, $30. So,
yeah, wow.
Yeah, so I looked at this and I thought, so it's got 6 days left to go on it. I don't know what this is eventually going to go for. It looks also like maybe one of the switches over there on the right might be snapped off, but it's possible you could get a replacement switch from
Inside. Looks like you're replacing
with
a short toggle switch, like a flat toggle switch.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure where MSI is at the moment in terms of, Todd Fisher and that whole situation of selling spare parts and that kind of thing. I haven't looked into that for a while. But you used to be able to get sets of these toggle switches. They weren't cheap, but
yeah,
if you needed a replacement set, you could get one.
We were talking about him at the club meeting because, there's a whole thing, too, where Vince Breel was going to buy MSI and that whole thing, from Todd Fisher. And then I think we mentioned it in the news on the show about, maybe I did or whatever, about him, he's going to sell the War Games MSI again.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no real lot of information about, I guess just he's selling it. It's not like at an auction or anything.
Right. But, I don't know. I'd seen that too. But in any event, I wonder what this is going to go for. I wonder if it's going to kind of slide under the radar, or maybe if it won't go for as much as one would if it had the top lid. Or I'm just kind of curious. I guess we'll know in 6 days.
It should
put
be pretty easy to
put a plexiglass on the top and call it a museum piece. Who really needs the top lid? You can let people look at the inside while it's working.
Yeah, but I would think you could get a reproduction, probably made not too much money, couldn't you?
Although I kind of like the plexiglass idea. That's pretty fun.
Yeah. I used to have an S100 computer that had a plexiglass top.
Yeah?
A smoked plexiglass top. Yeah, it was pretty neat.
Cool.
So it was like some generic S100. It didn't have a front panel. It was a turnkey.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's like what my S100 systems are. But, the chassis, they're not really a system. So anyway, that's what we got on eBay. This is one of those that I might not mind coming back to next time and seeing what it ultimately went for. So I might just cover that briefly on the next RCR. I think
you
that
guys made us stop doing it.
Well, sometimes it's kind
wasn't
of boring,
my idea.
But sometimes it's kind of fun to go back and see see what they are. But wow, are we done? This is just this has been a fun one.
We're just warming up.
Yeah, we're just getting started here. But we're to the closing discussions. So, David, what have you got for us? Close us out here.
Okay, well, see, the only thing I got was more about my book.
Yeah?
I finally got off the can. I don't know what the saying is. Finally, you know, made it happen. I decided, you know, by God, I'm going to finally make this an e-book version of this. And it really all, because, you know, the book itself, when I sent it digitally to the printer, it's a PDF already. So the bulk of the book, not counting the covers, it already existed as a PDF. So what I had to do was essentially take the big file, that's the two-page covers, and split that in half and crop it properly and position it, you know, so that it flows like a proper e-book. So anyway, to make the story short is I took, you know, my book and I laid it out properly, and then I included the classic computing zine where it's all one file. And so it's one ebook, but it's a PDF ebook. It's not an EPUB or whatever, the different other things. So now I'm selling that. So it's $7.99, or it's $25 if you want. I still have some of the printed books and the zine left. And then if you want to get a bundle, the whole bundle, for $30, essentially you can get the ebook for $5 more. You can do that. But anyway, so I think that worked out really well. And I've actually sold, it's kind of neat, I've sold probably, 20 of them or so. It's pretty good.
Of the e-books?
And then it seems like it's helped sell a few more of the other books. You know, it's kind of stopped now. I announced it and stuff and sold some, so haven't sold any in the last few days. But I'm kind of excited about it. I think it's neat.
I don't know. But, I'll pimp it on RetroBits and on the other
big,
things.
It's big, though. It's almost 500 megabytes.
Yeah.
Half a gig. But the quality is very good, you know, when you look at it in a
very nice writer.
It looks nice.
Yeah, so I'm happy about that. So that's my big news.
At $8, I think everybody within the sound of our voice should go out and get that thing because it's a deal. It's a bargain at any price, but it's very interesting reading. And you know.
Yeah. So pretty much once I sell the rest of the printed books, I'm not going to print anymore unless there's some real big reason to do so. I mean, all of a sudden if it gets big and people demand it or whatever, maybe I'll print them. But you know, yeah, that'll be it on the run of the printed books.
But that's nice that it'll be there at $8 as an ebook for posterity. For good that would be preserved. Cool.
Yep.
So Jeff, what about you?
Well, me, I'm going to continue with my retro challenge for the rest of the month. And just hours ago, I got some new retro stuff to play around with from a odd but interesting ham radio chat with somebody. I don't know if you're familiar with ham radio.
Mm-hmm. KB6JIV.
K1TUX.
Nice.
I actually was working on an antenna. I was fixing an antenna that my daughter broke, unfortunately, but I was testing it out yesterday, and I got in a conversation, or as they call it in the vernacular, a QSL, QSL. I was on a talk with somebody for over 2 hours about... I'm talking about the radio stuff. Every ham radio person always talks about the size of their antennas. I don't know if you heard it. That was the dogs barking. But
we heard it.
But it led to, I didn't realize this person lives two counties away from me, and he was a programmer and electronics repairman for most of his career. He programmed Commodore 64 stuff in assembler, even created a couple games for Access Software doing that. And he learned that I was into, you know, collecting the old computers and stuff. So what he did is he emailed me in D64 format all his source code for what he did in assembler, including some of the stuff he did for MS-DOS. That'll give me plenty of stuff to play with. He even had some interesting code. I'd like to try it out sometime, but he actually, let's see, usually when you program in assembler, you have to compile your code, create the executable, so to speak, and tried running it, you know, save it to disk and run it. So he had two computers. He would save the disk, put the disk in the other computer, and run it. But then eventually he decided to connect the two computers, the Commodore 64s, together through the user port, so he would assemble it straight to RAM in the other computer and run it directly on the other computer. I thought, oh, that's interesting. I got to see how you did that.
No kidding.
But he sent me his code, and I will eventually get around to looking at it, but it's real interesting stuff. I'm going to ask him if he's okay with me passing some of it around, but right now he entrusted me to it, so I'm going to see what it is and discuss it with him and find out if he wants to share some of it, because I know there's people out there who would be interested in seeing this stuff. Guy's not into much in modern computing. I think the latest thing he has is Windows XP, but he likes to run a lot of stuff in DOS mode. But then again, I think he's versed enough in computers and programming that he writes his own stuff for what he wants to do. So, and he can do it at the DOS level, apparently, very well. So that's going to keep me busy for a while. I'll blow the dust off of two Commodore 64s. I usually have one running at any time, and I'd like to try that user port thing. That would be great.
Fun.
He just creates, like, TSR-type programs that, that reside in memory and run in the background, and it monitors the user port activity.
And since he's the one doing the programming, he can know which block of memory it would be safe to put that code into.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure he's well-versed on the entire memory map of the computer, and he could probably do some really interesting tricks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anybody who can program an assembler knows the hardware.
Cool.
I can't program an assembler.
I can hack around a little bit in assembler.
Binary? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, ones and zeros. Yeah, we're down with that.
So tell us more about Japan.
Well, so it was such a fun trip, and everything there is so busy. I mean, it's crowded, famously. And when we were in Tokyo, we had to visit some of the more crowded spots, like the, I don't know if you guys have seen Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift, where the cars come sliding through the big intersection.
My kids are watching the third movie, which I don't know which one that is. The third, just like Saturday, they were watching it yesterday, I guess.
But there's this scene where the cars come sliding through this giant pedestrian intersection.
In the city?
Yeah, it's a Shinjuku crossing. And so I was actually standing there a week and a half ago taking video, and that was so much fun to see it up close. I mean, you've got sights and sounds and things bombarding you from all sides, you know, electronic signs and things flashing and people shouting at you as you're walking down. They're shouting about their wares, you know, usually food. And
like Times Square 2.0?
Yeah, exactly. It is just such a rush to
be in that
place.
And you understood a little bit of Japanese? A
little bit, yeah. Some. Enough to get around. I mean, between our broken Japanese, and my son's had a couple of years of college Japanese, so he's bootstrapped a little bit there. And with our Nexus 7 kind of guiding us around with GPS when we would get a little lost. Between all that, we survived. We had a great time. We visited both Tokyo and Osaka, and also visited a little town outside of Osaka called Nara, which was the Japanese provisional capital something like 1,300 years ago. And it's an amazing ancient city where a friend of mine lives that used to be my Japanese tutor here in the States. And so anyway, we had such a great time. I'm just now, I think, finally getting over the jet lag because it's a 16-hour difference. And
wow. Yeah, that's on this whole day.
I thought a couple days after I got back that I was over it, and then a day or two later I realized I wasn't quite. But now, I think I'm doing pretty good now. But anyway, a couple places that we visited that might be of interest to retro nerds is one is called Akihabara, or often abbreviated Akiba, and it's nicknamed the Electric City. And it's where you go in Japan for electronics, computers, and anime, that kind of stuff, the kind of collection of all that. And we saw a bunch of stores with electronics and even a couple that had retro electronics. Like, I almost brought home a Super Famicom, the Japanese version of the Super NES. It was really cheap there. And if you go in the back streets of Akiba, you can find retro consoles or old boards from arcade games, that kind of stuff. Another place we visited is called Denden, short for Denki Electric, and that was in the Osaka region, and it's similar. Again, it's this whole district where they sell electronic stuff. And some of the deals there were incredible, and people love it. And you can tell it's a very high percentage of nerds and also an Akiba anime enthusiasts that are there. So, yeah, good trip. Glad
to
be home.
Go one day.
Yeah, you should go. It was
but you didn't go
fun.
To Disneyland, did you?
Didn't go to Tokyo
How
Disney.
How could you go to Tokyo and not go to Disneyland?
That's a time and money thing. We were doing Japan on the cheap. So...
And if I'm not mistaken, because I know a lot about cities in Japan, I recognize Osaka, but then you said Nara, and I think that's where the fake Disneyland was. I don't know if you ever heard of that, but there was for many years there was like a ripoff Disneyland in Japan, and it was built like I think Walt Disney was still alive when they first built it, so he wasn't real happy about it, and then it finally went defunct some years ago. I guess after they built the real Disneyland and stuff.
How so fascinating.
Smaller and more efficiently, right?
But if you look at some pictures of it during its heyday, it's like amazing the
Disneyland clone.
How much it was ripped off or whatever.
Or Disneyland compatible, we like to say. Yeah. That's hilarious. All right, well, guys, this was...
Time to go. Carrington didn't make it. Can you believe that?
Bummer, that guy...
He's off the show, too.
Right, that's it. It's back to you, David. But Jeff, thanks a million for being on the show today, being a guest.
Oh yeah, but you gotta do it close to the
microphone. Yeah.
I'll pull a Carrington stunt here. I'll open this.
Gotta do it 1 megahertz style.
Well, it's been a while since I heard a 1 megahertz. It's a little far behind. This is Panasonic. I think it's Crazy Maisie, and very nondescript case.
Hmm. It's that sort of VHS style case.
But it is sealed from 1982.
Wow.
You're going to let out the 80s air.
I'm going to let out the 80s air and see what it smells like. Probably like an old bag of chips.
Drum roll.
Yeah. All right. Hey, it's still just as shiny outside of the plastic.
And you're going to play it?
I don't have the thing hooked up yet, but...
I like the graphics.
That 80s air.
Love the graphics there.
This is it.
Of course,
a cassette tape.
Oh wow!
And with a dot matrix printer printed label.
Yeah, look at that.
Very cool.
They went all out on this. Panasonic warranty. Might be out of warranty now.
Hold on, you might need that, so hold on to that.
Yeah, better.
Yeah. Send in the registration card.
Within 15 days of opening, yeah. And the instruction book.
I love the
color. Single sheet of folded 8.5 by 11 paper. Shiny side and instructions.
Hmm.
Wow. Not very... double-sided, just in case the first side doesn't work.
Huh.
And that's it. It was recorded... Oh, okay, here... I guess the Panasonic had two different speeds for data load. There is a 600-baud side and a 2400-baud side.
Hmm.
I guess some computers did have that. The TRS-80, I believe, had that, too. Two-speed cassette loads. I think they had, like, 300 and 600 or something like that.
What, do you mean the other one just meant to be a backup in case the high-speed one didn't work?
Yeah, or maybe, yeah, probably.
Or do the computers themselves have a different baud rate, depending on which model you have?
It's hard to say. I don't know if there was a series of computers like this, or if it was just this one, and maybe the slower baud rate is for people who have lousy recorders or tape players. It would just, play it back at a slower speed. It'll probably be read a lot better.
The lower speed might be handy with a cassette that's over 30 years old.
Yeah, and there used to be a way you could tell if tape is starting to degrade. Braid, and I can't tell. It's still in the pink leader, so I'm almost afraid to turn it with a pencil.
The odds are it's probably
fine, pencil
probably
and spin it around
though.
A few times to rewind
right?
it.
I would say the odds are probably it's okay.
I think the odds are good.
It probably is. It depends on how it was stored. When I received it, well, I think the person who owned it before me probably kept very good care of it because that's the one I got all that Commodore collection from, and he kept care. Yeah, all that stuff was in pristine condition when I got it, so I assume he kept good care of it. And when I received this, I didn't put it anywhere near big magnets. So, since it was sealed, you know, a lot of the dank basement air probably didn't get into it either. Maybe that's what I was smelling.
Until now.
Yeah, now it's done.
It's done. I have a few more, too, but...
Cool.
I'm not going to open them now.
This is going to be a long show, isn't it?
Ah, we're doing all right. We're doing all right.
Are we? It's like, haven't we? We've been on like an hour and 40 minutes.
You're just waiting for Karen to come in. Right?
That's right. We're dragging our feet.
Carrington.
I don't think he can hear us.
That's he's all right, though.
He's gone to a better place.
Did you take his motorcycle?
I think so. Yeah, I'm pretty certain, right?
Yep, that's what he was planning. So unless something changed at the last minute.
Like rain.
Yeah. Or the motorcycle dying.
Yeah. I don't know. I was never I was only a fair weather rider. Not one drop of rain, I'd have to put it away.
Probably a good idea. Just for safety, if nothing else.
Especially after hot days, all that oil on the road slicking up.
First rain, yep.
Yep.
Well, all right. Well, thanks again, Jeff. It was great to have you on the RCR.
Thanks for having me.
And it was fun to actually be on the RCR with you, because I didn't get the chance to last time. So that's it for this show. Our next show will be on Sunday, August 4th at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific. It's the homecoming show. We're getting the band back together. David, Carrington, and Earl, at least as far as we know right now. You'll find show notes for today's show, plus all the past shows, all of them, every single one, at rcrpodcast.com. Join us in the forums over at the vintage-computer.com/VCForum. It's a very good forum. Lots of activity going on there for all sorts of computers and activities. We're on Twitter at our handle, RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to, as luck would have it, feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And say something about us on iTunes. Just, you know, we hate it when it's too quiet over there. So go over to iTunes and make some noise. And until next time, retrocompute.
Goodbye, everyone.
Retrocompute.